Today's May 11th, 2015. This is a Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Today we have a work session on the Department of Agriculture federal grant application and a public hearing on Senate Bill 5511. We're going to start off with the public hearing. We'll probably break in the middle of that once we reach a quorum and then shift over to the work session. So with that, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5511. And we'll call up Director Melcher and Ms. Connolly.
Mr. Chair, if I just might note for the record that there are some responses from the Department of Environmental Quality from last week's hearing to some questions, and those are posted under last Monday's meeting, which was DEQ's meeting date.
I almost forgot that. I did forget that.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the director with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Here today to begin our phase two of this Ways and Means process. And our presentation today and tomorrow will address a number of key issues that Mr. Siebert and LFO had asked us to focus on. So we will go through first in-depth discussion of our current fee proposal and the process that we went through to arrive at that proposal. Then also, as requested by Mr. Siebert, we will be highlighting the differences between the agency request budget and the governor's request budget. And then lastly, and I expect to get to it tomorrow, we will talk about our 070 reduction package and the programs that will be eliminated absent the revenue necessary to continue those programs, as well as discuss in depth our policy option packages. And with that, as we look at a photo here of Diamond Lake, or Mount Thielson from Diamond Lake, I would then move in. And it's important. Much of this is redundant. It was embedded in our earlier Ways and Means, but it's an important part of telling the story in terms of how we arrived at the current fee proposal. So, and I'll go quickly through these and try not to spend too much time on the pieces that are redundant. Nonetheless, in 2009, our agency fee structure was set. That's the last time that our fees were adjusted here by legislative action. We have, at that time in 2009, when the fees were structured, and at that time some were increased, there were a few that were decreased. For instance, in 2009, we decreased the cost of youth participation through creation of a youth sport pack. At that time, in 2009, we projected that the fee structure would sustain the department's programs and our important conservation and stewardship efforts for 6 years, or through 2015. We have, at this point here today, fulfilled that commitment. There's a number of the one piece where we have fallen short, I guess, if you will, is through more reductions in our basically our cash reserves, and there's a number of reasons for that compared to what we projected in 2009. Firstly, we saw lower than projected non-resident participation in fishing and hunting. We think that was a combination of the impact of raising fees, also at the same time that the great economic downturn, which we think led to less non-resident participation. There were, over the last 6 years, additionally legislative fund shifts associated with general fund being at a premium, and some of the department's general fund funded programs, in particular state police enforcement, were shifted onto licensed dollars. And then lastly, lower than projected interest earnings. As an agency that carries a large balance, part of our revenue model and part of our projections include interest earnings on our balances. Number of challenges that face the department, first and foremost, is hunting and fishing participation. We've seen, certainly if you go back multiple decades, we've seen declines in the state, and actually declines in the West, in hunting and fishing participation. Over the last decade, looking at it since 2005, our participation numbers through basically as indicated by purchases of licenses have been flat. At the same time, over those multiple decades, we've seen generally reduced trends in general fund support for the agency. And at the same time, we've had increased demands for service, whether that be in the form of managing a new and expanding wolf population in Oregon, increased management complexities associated with multiple ESA listings, both in the aquatic and the terrestrial environment. So, for instance, in the Columbia Basin alone, we have 12 ESA-listed salmon stocks and numerous terrestrial species as well. Talking then a little bit about our budget drivers, again, this is redundant, but looking at the agency's budget, fully 50% of our revenue comes from anglers and hunters, both in the form of license fees as well as in the form of federal excise tax on fishing equipment as well as arms and ammunition. The other half of our budget then is made up of mostly what would be considered obligated funds. So, for instance, the federal funds wedge at 25%, those are all contractual funds that come with specific activities associated with the contracts. Small piece of lottery dollars. You'll see general fund. This is in the governor's request budget. General fund at 8%. And then obligated. Those are funds associated with, for instance, restoration enhancement surcharge on fishing licenses, access and habitat surcharge on hunting licenses, and other obligated accounts, not fungible or discretionary. And we talked a little bit about this earlier as well, the user pay model, if you will, the North American model of wildlife management, which was really expanded in the 1930s to include not only license and tag sales, but also the excise taxes on firearms, ammunition, and fishing tackle. This has been a very successful funding model, both in terms of the excise tax as well as the license and tag sales to manage hunting and fishing activities as well as conservation efforts as it relates to fish and wildlife. Again, redundant, but the figure of our budget driver of our resident and non-resident hunting participation, if you look at the participation from 2005 to 2014, it's been roughly flat. Some ebb and flow over the last decade, but generally flat. Same can be seen on the non-resident participation level with actually some very slight trends over the last 5 years in increased participation. Similarly, on the resident and non-resident anglers, again, generally flat. If you look at our sales in 2005 versus our sales in 2014, they're virtually identical with some interannual variability across that that time span. Meanwhile, we work on important wildlife stewardship efforts across the state. Wildlife viewing is one important component of the wildlife economy, if you will. We have an estimated, based on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service surveys, an estimated 1.4 million participants each year that take part in wildlife viewing. This provides significant economic benefit, both in terms of travel-related expenditures as well as equipment-related purchases. And for the department, though, there's very little associated revenue coming from these activities. And I say little because there is some. For instance, over the last decade, we've implemented a parking permit program at our wildlife areas. So wildlife viewers that come to the wildlife areas now have to purchase a parking permit and help support management of that area. And we have developed a non-compulsory habitat conservation stamp for individuals to contribute to conservation and stewardship efforts with the department. I mentioned this earlier. Additional budget drivers include the work that we do on behalf of other agencies. We serve largely as the consulting agency for other state agencies as it relates to fish and wildlife. We conduct permit reviews both for a number of agencies, state agencies, as well as federal and local municipalities. We participate in the Governor's Regional Solutions Project or program, economic development activities. And then, as I mentioned, great deal of work associated with Endangered Species Act constraints, in particular on our fisheries where we have recreational fisheries and commercial fisheries that impact ESA-listed stocks. There's a great deal of effort that goes into managing those fisheries to maintain our fishery impacts within allowed rates. There's a number of, as we've talked, there's been a number of bills here in the legislature this session that would help us address broadening the base, if you will, for funding these activities. House Bill 3315 would direct us to track and then later in future biennia recover costs associated with other state agencies' permit reviews. So these are fee-funded permit reviews. and also House Bill 2402, which creates a legislative task force to look at alternative funding models for doing important fish and wildlife conservation and stewardship work.
Actually, this is probably a good time to break, and we'll do a work session really quickly.
Very good.
So we'll go ahead and keep the public hearing open, but we'll go ahead and open a work session on the Department of Agriculture's federal grant application. And we'll turn it over to Mr. Siebert.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have before you a request from the Department of Agriculture to submit a $100,000 federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Agriculture Farm to School program to improve access to local foods in schools. The department was one of only 8 states selected to participate in the USDA pilot for procurement of unprocessed fruits and vegetables, and the department would use the grant funds if successful for this pilot program. The grant has a 25% non-federal match, which the department would meet primarily through in-kind staff and through the from the Food Corps, and no new positions will be created.
And it looks like there's some folks from the department.
Good morning, Chair Rayfield and members of the committee. Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Paul gave you a really good description of why we're here. This is a permission to apply for a USDA federal grant for our Farm to School program. I will mention that Oregon, I believe, was one of the first states in the nation to actually have staffing in 2 different state agencies, the Department of Education and the Department of Agriculture, for the Farm to School programs. And I will tell you that this program is growing. It's exciting to see it mature over the years, and to be able to have that partnership with agribusiness in Oregon, as well as our school system, to actually put children in school connected to agriculture, either through school gardens or even beyond that, putting locally sourced food into their school lunch programs. With that, I just want to, we won't take much time because I know you want to get back to ODF&W, but I wanted Gary Roth, who is sitting here with me. He's our program manager for our marketing and development program. And then I'm really pleased to have Leah Kleproth with us. She's our Food Corps fellow. Food Corps will be providing a significant amount of the match for this grant in kind, and really boots on the ground for this. So, Gary, why don't you just real quick.
Co-chair, members of the committee. Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. Got an ear infection, so I'm not really hearing anything that I'm saying. So anyway, actually, Farm to School and school gardens really were thriving actually right at the time of the Second World War with the Victory Gardens. And there are several really great photographs out there that I've seen both in the urban areas of Portland and around the state. But over the years, like with a lot of things, that kind of fell by the wayside. And about the time of the economic downturn in 08, some of the leadership of this body, including Representative Clem, as well as the Oregon School and School Garden Network, really saw some wisdom in forming a farm-to-school program within the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Our initial work was really to build recognition, if you will, among the not only vendors, but with the schools and school districts about the opportunity. There were several out there that were interested, but really didn't know how to go about procuring more local products. The advantages, obviously, are not only economic, because it helps to fuel the purchases of Oregon products consumed by Oregon children, but also to improve the health and diet, and really teach people at a very impressionable time in their lives about the choices that can be made throughout a lifetime for better health. As the recognition built, we realized that it was going to be challenging with one staff person to build a sale of one product at one school district at a time. And so obviously leveraging our partnership with several districts, volunteers, the Food Corps program, which Oregon was one of the first states to have Food Corps, which is a outgrowth of AmeriCorps, if you're not familiar with the program, to really begin leveraging the opportunities and institutionalizing them. Then we were able to add, as Lauren said, we were the first state to have 2 positions for Farm to School, one with hello, Representative Clem. I just said some nice things
I heard,
but we'll come back to that.
That's why I'm
to have 2 positions, one with the Department of Agriculture and one within the Department of Education. The Department of Agriculture then was able to concentrate more on the supply side, Department of Education to work more closely on the demand or the pull side, and really working where they work best, which is in the procurement processes. This grant would allow us to extend the reach of Food Corps. It would allow us to extend the reach into the more of the rural areas. We do have Food Corps throughout the state, but we'd like to expand more into central and eastern Oregon, and also to work closely with the Agribusiness Council to recognize some now 200 vendors that are selling products to Oregon schools and build that recognition, sort of a brand awareness, if you will. If one vendor knows that another is selling to farm to school, if that's a demarcation in the marketplace that helps them not only in farm-to-school sales but other sales, then that's a market advantage for them. So I'll stop there.
Good morning, Chair Rayfield and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Leah Klaproth, Food Corps Fellow. I'm just here to talk a little bit about Food Corps and what we're doing here in Oregon already and what we hope to do with this grant. Food Corps is a national nonprofit that places AmeriCorps service members on the ground for an 11-month term to work on farm to school, meaning changing what's on children's lunch trays by connecting them to local farms and local food, building and tending school gardens, and teaching hands-on nutrition education through cooking programs. Food Corps was originally started in 2011, and Oregon was one of the original states that was awarded Food Corps program. It's hosted by the Department of Agriculture in Oregon, which is the only state where a state agency is the host site partner. We started with four service sites across Oregon. Now in 2015, we are in 10 sites. We only right now have one site east of the Cascades. So a big focus of this grant would be to expand to rural eastern Oregon and southern Oregon. We also, with this grant, hope to partner with Oregon Business Council's Adopt a Farmer program, where we will pilot with our Food Corps schools to bring farmers into the classroom and to bring classrooms out to farms. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Hansel.
A couple of quick questions, Gary or whoever. The way I understand this, the Department of Agriculture will make the application, but the grant money will actually go to Food Corps. Is that the way this is envisioned?
Chair Rayfield, Senator Hansel, that we will apply for the grant. The states, I think, are the only ones that can apply for these dollars. We will receive those dollars into the department, and then those dollars, and correct me if I'm wrong, Leah, will actually be used. Our part of that, or the expenditure, is our staff time and the match to go that. But it will actually be the infrastructure. Those monies will come out from our department to help set up those additional sites that Leah was talking about.
Follow up. I know you're probably very familiar with it, but just to be on the record that, you know, in rural eastern Oregon, where I'm from, that one organization that's in most of the high schools is the FFA, which if many of them already have greenhouses and pretty much in production that way, is, you know, certainly encourage you to partner with them as well.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Hansel, that's something that we would like to extend the reach on. We have talked about that within our program, and also a part of this grant proposal does propose to increase the educational opportunities around not only agriculture but food systems and food processing. And I think particularly, as you say, FFA is strong in many rural communities, including your part of the state, and I believe not including them would be not a good thing, because as I say, we're looking for every opportunity to leverage. We're really sitting here as the coordinator, and we would welcome that opportunity.
Great.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Well, I'm a big farm school fan and had done it when I ran a school lunch program, so I appreciate that you're here and continuing this conversation a decade later. Prioritization of free and reduced program schools, is that in your criteria as you look to distribute these grants? That would be my request is that schools where you've got a high propensity for free and reduced lunch participation tend to benefit from these types of programs, just because of the lack of connection at the home for these kids to understand and see and where does their food come from. So I don't know if that's in your criteria set for distributing grants, but I just want to get on the record that that would be where I would want you to be directing any grant dollars that come in.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Parrish. As I mentioned earlier, we look to not only leverage grant dollars, but opportunities that we have with other partners and stakeholders in the program. And as we look at, particularly, I think, the state program, which allocates expenditures, which has been primarily handled by the Department of Education, I think that certainly weighs into the criteria. As for the free and reduced, we do weigh that as we look for service sites for Food Corps, but we also look at communities that have the infrastructure, the capacity to support the site member. So we look at both criteria in that regard.
All right, Chair.
Yes, Senator Dimbrough.
Thank you. I, too, am very supportive of this program. But I have a question about the unprocessed part of the grant, and I ask that only because this came up in another committee that I serve on, where we have a tax credit for unprocessed donations to food banks or donation of unprocessed crops. So how unprocessed do the unprocessed foods need to be? Over there was a question of whether just shelling peanuts or washing fruits and vegetables doesn't make them processed.
I should just keep this up here. Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Dembrough, the application refers to the USDA pilot for procurement of unprocessed fruits and vegetables, which actually was in the Farm Bill and pushed forward by Oregon Senator Wyden. And I think we are one of the only states that actually have that pilot program. As with many programs, it is well-intended. There is a great opportunity there, but there are the devil is in the details, so to speak, in terms of how to actually make those transactions take place between the vendor and the processor. So part of what we want to do is apply some additional resources or efforts, if you will, not only by ourselves but our partners, to make that pilot more make sure that it is successful. The name there is the title in the Farm Bill. It's unprocessed. Unprocessed actually means fresh. So initially cut, handled, washed is fine. We are always interested in not only the unprocessed or the fresh products, but also processed can tend to have a kind of a dirty name in the marketplace. But also, not every product is available in Oregon 12 months out of the year. So we recognize that initially processed, frozen. We have to call fresh frozen. We're trying to get people to think of that as healthy choices as well.
All right. Are there any other questions? With that, I would accept a motion to move the LFO recommendation on this grant.
Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request to submit a $100,000 federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Agriculture to support the pilot for procurement of unprocessed fruits and vegetables.
But now I would accept the motion to move the LFO recommendation.
So if you want to move the LFO recommendation.
Shocker coming from Representative Clem moves the LFO recommendation on his pet project. Is there any discussion on the motion? All right, seeing no discussion, is there any objection to the motion?
Project, I might have to
object. All right, seeing no objection, the motion carries.
And to full.
The full.
Carry it to the full if you wish.
Sure. Absolutely, Senator Hansel will carry to full. So with that, we'll go ahead and close the work session on grant application.
It just goes to full.
And we'll go ahead and bring up Director Melcher and Ms. Connolly.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. Again, for the record, Kurt Melcher, Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. So in moving forward, as we reviewed our budget beginning actually almost 2 years ago, and we identified a gap for 15-17 budget cycle, and that would be a $32 million gap between projected revenues and projected expenses. This gap is based on a variety of working assumptions. First working assumption is that we wanted to restore our working capital, that we would fully fund all programs without restrictions. That is to say, we would not hold, this assumes no holding of positions vacant or restrictions on purchase of technology, essentially fully fund the programs without such management restrictions, that we would expect increased costs due to inflation. So those are projected in the expenditures for 15-17. And then lastly, and very importantly, that we would fully fund OSP Fish and Wildlife Division requests. We, again, wanted to do this exercise over a six-year planning horizon. And actually, let me go back on that. So over a six-year planning horizon, we recognize that over time there's ebbs and flows, and we're going to talk a little bit about why or how we've changed this proposal as opposed to our previous six-year planning horizon model. Looking forward then, we want to, of course, keep expenditures within projected revenues, and we've done developed a number of new tools that help us do that. We also want to look at strategies for ways to improve our revenue. And we talked a lot in our phase one ways and means about some of these strategies, from regulation simplification to mobile applications to hunter education, recruitment and retention and reactivation efforts with the department. But we also wanted to make sure that our fee proposal was also not a barrier. So, and we're going to talk about each of these in depth a little bit later, but at a very high level, our public process then included a survey of 58,000 licensed hunters and anglers, included focus groups. We have a standing external budget advisory committee that helps us each session when we develop our budget, and we engage them not only in budget development but also in the fee proposal development. From that, we had a new number of town hall meetings, eight, I believe, across the state to take public comments on our draft proposal. And then prior to our commission adopting the agency requested budget, we, of course, had a commission meeting where individuals both testified as well as provided written comments to the commission. And, of course, we've been reaching out to a number of groups and organizations by making presentations, answering questions, et cetera. As a result of all that public interaction, we have a number of things that we learned, if you will. And it's interesting, but when we go out, even absent a fee proposal, when we go out on our budget town hall meetings every other year, most people come to talk to us not about the budget, not about the fee proposal, but about a variety of other issues where they think there are things we could be doing to make hunting and fishing better, or things that they think we are doing that is making hunting and fishing worse. So from that, and we talked about these in our earlier phase one, and I won't go into them all in detail, but we have a number of initiatives, if you will, that we are looking at to make hunting and fishing better in Oregon. We're looking, as I mentioned, to attract new hunters and anglers, as well as retaining and reactivating existing anglers. And then we had a lot of comment on the importance of the agency's conservation mission, implementing our conservation and recovery plans, as well as managing and conserving all of fish and wildlife, and a great deal of recognition amongst our constituents that habitat is the key. So as we developed this strategy for balancing the budget, we really came with a three-pronged approach with you, if you will, focused on reductions. And these are reductions that we're not proposing to buy back with any fee proposal. Shifting to alternative revenue, including a portion of that onto general fund, as well as our fee adjustment. We talked a lot about this. I won't go into any great details, but we've taken great strides to be more efficient in our activities. We continue to work to improve our processes and reduce our administrative overhead. program reductions. From our public input, when we talk to the public, these are the things they tell us. They want us to maintain field staff. They want us to not reduce assistant district fish biologists. That they want us to maintain our hatchery production. As a result of that feedback, in our initial budget proposal with program reductions, we identified, I believe it's 48, it could be 50, I may have my math wrong here, positions that we slated for elimination that we're proposing to eliminate in the department's budget. We're not proposing to buy these back with any associated fee or other revenue package. We covered these in detail in our phase one. These are technically part of the 070 reduction package, 27 on the fish-funded programs, 11 positions in regions, and 10 positions in administration. Again, listening to public input, we had broad support from our fishing and hunting community constituents that they wanted the general public to bear a greater burden of the cost of fish and wildlife management in the state. They wanted us to continue to pursue alternative revenue sources, a great deal of concern about predators, predator management, and ultimately the fact that this is impacting not only hunting revenue, but the way we spend hunter dollars. Also interest in realigning our revenues and expenditures within the department to match the beneficiaries. So that is to say, interest among some segments of the public to say that hatcheries should be paid for by fishing license dollars. And then, of course, a great deal of concern if the department does not receive the revenues necessary to fulfill the package. So POP 101, we're not talking about specifically today, but we talked about earlier, is basically shifting to other revenue sources, including a portion of which on the state general fund. And then I want to talk a little bit about the kind of the pathway that we've been on here over the last year and a half or so. We began our license fee review with a survey of staff. Included focus groups. These are non-agency focus groups. Our focus groups included two types of people from our fishing and hunting license database. It included long-time continuous license purchasers in separate groups, and then it included what we would refer to as newbies, people who just bought their first license within the last 2 years, so that we could get a feel for what and how we can modify our fees to not only not impact the long-time consistent license buyers, but also the people who are really more on the margins, what we look at as the new participants. And this work culminated ultimately with a survey that we're going to talk about here in a minute. Then, just to recap our agency goals, maintaining priority programs, including hatchery production, field staff, minimizing impacts on participation. We don't want our fee proposal to be one that provides negative incentives for participation. As a result, we looked at strategic adjustments rather than just simply across-the-board adjustments, and we looked at two-year increments as opposed to our long-standing model, which was one increase, fairly large increase that's then flat for 6 years. We're looking at 2 year incremental increases. Again, we're looking to promote participation by youth and families, so we have further reduced fees for youth participation, and that segues into our new license concepts as well. So digging down a little deeper then into the public involvement, we had 8 focus groups, as I mentioned earlier. From Portland, Eugene, Medford, Bend, and LeGrand, it included both avid as well as new participants. We had an ideation session to generate as many ideas as possible, and believe me, we got a lot of ideas, ranging everything from charge people for a bird watching license to start selling sea lion tags, all of which were the result of over 500 ideas generated through the ideation sessions. Ultimately, we sent out a public survey to 58,000 of our licensed, and they could have been formerly licensed, so they did not necessarily have to be active. They were both a mix of resident and non-resident, as well as current and lapsed license purchasers. We had a pretty reasonable response rate to that 58,000 inquiries with a little over 11,000 residents, as well as 6,000 non-residents that responded to our survey.
Yes, Representative Parrish.
Can I just ask a couple questions on these licenses? Because this is truly not my wheelhouse. I don't hunt, I don't fish, I don't do any of these things. But I want to give you some feedback that I heard from my own parent, who is now no longer living in Oregon, who is a non-resident, but lived here for decades. And, you know, just feels like the fees are such that when he comes to visit, he doesn't even want to fish here because they're nothing like where he's at in Nevada, where they're out filling their freezer with trout, of all things, just gross. But, you know, but they, sorry to the trout guy in the room, but it's just not my favorite thing. But I look at this, and you've got buyers who are lapsed. I mean, what do you do to go back and get those folks or reach out to those non-residents like my dad, who feels really frustrated that he's a former Oregon resident. He can't even come here and fish because it just doesn't feel affordable or that the value's not there. I have to get, you know, sense that if you had some people who were in that universe and you have their data, like, what are we doing to reach out to those folks and offer, you know, incentivize them to come back and get a license? Do you do that type of stuff?
Sure. Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Paris, absolutely. And so one of our focuses in the future is many of our customers are interacting with us online. They're purchasing licenses online. So we're developing a great – of course, we know who all of our customers are. That's a good thing. But we may not have the ability to contact them electronically. So we have done some direct mail promotions in partnership with the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation to – reactivate folks who do not currently have a license but have purchased one in the past. But we're also really looking to the electronic media. In particular, we're right now developing the email database. So anyone who interacts with us online, we get their email address, and we can push out to them. We can do targeted marketing, basically. As it relates to non-resident fees, yes, non-resident fees are about five times higher than the resident fee structure. It's interesting, in 2009, in our fee proposal, we proposed increasing non-resident fees in the agency budget, and actually the non-resident fees that got adopted were higher than what we proposed. And we do think, and we have observed, at least initially, that was, we think, a barrier. You'll see in our package, and I don't have the details right here, but we're actually proposing to lower some non-resident fees in an effort to get some of those people back. And not just on the traditional non-resident angling license, if you will, but also, as I mentioned, our new youth angling license, which we now have a youth combined, what we're proposing is a youth combined license, which is fishing, hunting, and shellfish harvesting, all three activities. It's $10, and it covers both resident and non-resident juveniles, whereas prior or under the current structure, non-resident juveniles have to pay a much higher non-resident fee. So it is certainly something we're looking at.
So your licenses are down in terms of the number of people who are procuring a license. But how many licenses could you still sell and still have enough, like, stuff to hunt and fish? Like, at what point are you at capacity for your licenses based on how many deer you can go out and shoot right now or fish you could go catch? Like, what's the opportunity for growth in your license based on available stuff to hunt?
Sure. Representative Rayfield and Representative Parrish, great question, actually. And first of all, just I want to make sure the record's clear. We've been flat, for instance, in terms of license sales for a decade. So we're not still in the decline. We're flat. We're hopeful that some of our efforts to recruit, retain, and reactivate are working. And your question about where do we have the capacity to add customers, if you will, is a great question. There are certainly areas where we have capacity or the resources available. So, and it's a complex very complex picture, but when you look statewide at fishing opportunity, many of our fisheries are constrained by ESA impact limitations. So at least to a degree, we're unable to add new, quote-unquote, anglers into those at the same rate where we might be able to in other areas. But many of our fisheries are not do not suffer such constraints, and there is absolutely room to grow and add new anglers.
What about the follow-up? What about, like, the critters that you go out
with? Oh, sure.
I mean, like deer or whatever else you're letting people
Chair, see? Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Parrish, a similar story on the hunting side. For instance, many of our almost all of our Eastern Oregon hunting opportunity for deer is controlled, and that is to say we have a limited number of tags that we provide, and that's based on population status. So absent improvements in population status, there's not opportunity to add new, quote-unquote, or additional tags. That's not as much the case as it relates to many of our elk populations, certainly not the case as it relates to waterfowl. There is room to grow in terms of waterfowl hunting. And then similarly on black-tailed deer, our black-tailed deer populations are depressed from where they were in the 80s, for instance, even the early 90s. But a lot of that is due to changes in federal timber harvest and changes in habitat as a result of that. And so they're, and likewise, those tags are not limited. They're basically an over-the-counter tag that's not constrained. We can sell more of them. Certainly we have a lot of some predators in the state as well that could stand to have some additional hunting opportunity.
Last quick follow-up. So if in those categories where you have additional capacity to go out and hunt them and safely not hurt the population, I mean, it would make sense that if you drop the price of those tags that you'd actually see some volume that could help your budget. I mean, is that ever in your consideration set at all?
Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Parrish, we actually did look at that, not specific to individual tags, but the trade-off in terms of the number of new participants you have to add to make it revenue neutral or revenue increase is, when we look at it, it appears unrealistic to us. I will say, though, there are examples where it does work, and we did it with cougars. So the cougar tag in Oregon used to be, I think, $50 or $60. And post ballot measure 18 in 1994, without the use of hounds, the very, very few people purchased the tag. It was too expensive for the chance that you might see a cougar. In 2009, we greatly reduced the price of a cougar tag, and the volume has picked up tremendously. But that was that's a bit of a unique situation.
Okay.
Yep.
Have you done numbers? I've done an analysis of the angling and the hunting fees, say, go back 20, 30, 40 years and adjusted it for inflation to see what that looks like compared to what you're proposing now?
Co-Chair Rayfield, actually, the Secretary of State looked at that, and I think I have a slide.
We'll get to it.
I definitely have a slide. I just can't remember if it's in today's presentation or tomorrow's.
Perfect.
I think it's in today's, actually.
Yeah, Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First of all, I really support the idea of raising the fees in smaller but more regular increments. I think that makes a lot of sense in avoiding sticker shock. But I'm wondering just how much sticker shock there has been in the past. You know, when you've had these larger increases every 6 years, what has been the impact? Have the numbers really gone down? I know it may be hard to say with the last one because it coincided.
Yeah.
Did it coincide with the recession?
Yeah. Co-Chair Rayfield and Senator Denbrough, absolutely. There's always confounding factors when you raise a price, but then other things change, like the economy changes or population status changes, and we see responses we see consumer responses based on the status of the resource as well. But our revenue projections for this budget package actually include slightly reduced purchases based on some of the information that we've seen in previous years. Now, we don't know again, we don't know how much of any of those decreases were related to simply the price point versus other factors. But nonetheless, we've taken a conservative approach to modeling the revenue associated with this package and actually modeled for some slight decreases in those purchases.
All right. Please continue.
Okay. So we did survey, had excellent response. As we evaluated both the ideas, through the ideation session, as well as the public responses to our survey, we looked and evaluated each alternative based on the value to the customer. Does it provide new value? Does it provide value? Of course, the revenue impact, the feasibility. Obviously, issuing a sea lion tag is probably not feasible right now, nor is issuing a license for bird watching. Ability to implement. So we wanted to make sure that any proposals were, as we have a privatized license system, we want to make sure that any new proposals are something that we can actually implement through our private vendor. And then lastly, of course, we want to make sure our customers are interested. As we developed the final package, looking at all the information that we collected, evaluated them, looked at it internally amongst our executive leadership team, we looked and developed extensive new revenue modeling tools. So we looked specifically at sales histories, as Senator Dembrough was mentioning, buying patterns, participation trends, and developed our economists developed a pretty slick revenue model where we can essentially now make slight changes to any one of our dozens of fees, and the model projects out the impact over time, includes an algorithm for reduced participation based on the size of the increase. Smaller increases, of course, have less negative impact on participation. We took those through our external budget advisory committee process, arrived at a proposal that we then took out on to the town hall circuit. Listen to the public at the town hall hearings. One of the things most common in our initial reduction package, we had six assistant district biologists on the initial reduction package, and these were positions that we were not proposing to add back. Great groundswell of support for those positions, whether they be in Klamath Falls, Bend, or Clackamas. So we came back after the town hall meetings, and we incrementally increased our fees further in order to be able to add those six positions back into the package. Took that package to our commission, and the commission approved it in August of 2014. So our fee adjustments, which are basically encompassed in POP 102, they fund the agency's priority programs, hatcheries, field biologists, law enforcement. POP 102, again, has taken a structured approach with incremental increases over the next 6 years to minimize the impact on participation. They've been strategic adjustments, too, in that they do not raise any of the juvenile participation fees with regard to the sport pack, and they actually reduce juvenile participation fees associated with the new juvenile license. We believe the package, and since that juvenile license also applies to non-residents, we think that the package should be really viewed favorably by non-residents who want to come here as a family and participate. We had a number of other new license concepts. Perhaps the one that's garnered the most interest is our Pioneer License Program. Since 2000, the year 2000, the department has issued Pioneer licenses. These are licenses that are given to individuals who are at least 65 years of age and have been in Oregon for 50 years. It's basically self-certification. We have no way of going back and proving whether someone was, we certainly can prove their age, but we can't prove whether they were in the state for 50 years or not. So it's self-certification. The Pioneer licenses are issued for free. So under our current fee schedule, that's a combination fishing hunting license. It's a $65 license product under the current fee structure. One of the unfortunate parts about free licenses is we do not qualify for the federal match when we give a license away for free. So as it stands right now, the federal match associated with each fishing license that we sell is $7. The federal match associated with each hunting license that we sell is $13.
So to get, quick question, to get that match for the license, do we have to have a minimum charged to get that?
Co-Chair Ray Field and Representative Parrish, good question, and I will address that, absolutely. So as under the current structure, we do not qualify for what amounts to $20 in match for many of these license holders. It is one of our fastest growing demographics. I think our sales, our delivery of free Pioneer licenses over the last 6 years has increased about 25%. And we're up to 56,000 free combination licenses that we're issuing right now. So through our budget process, working with EBEC, the public, the commission, we are proposing to charge a $6 fee for this, what is currently a $65 license. In the future will be a $75 license. $6 is the minimum that we can charge and qualify for the federal match. So Representative Parrish, in answering your question, we are proposing to charge the minimum that then allows us to qualify for the $20 federal match associated with that.
Is that match an annual match, or is that a biennial match, or how does that come from the federal government?
Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Parrish, it is annual. So if you go and buy a fishing license tomorrow, next year when we send in our certification of 2015 licenses, or 2015 license certification to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we will qualify for an additional $7 of fish match. If you buy a combination license tomorrow, fishing hunting license, when we file our certification numbers for 2015, basically in 2016, we will qualify for an additional $20. This garnered a lot of interest, most of it negative. However, even in our survey where we had 17 plus thousand respondents, the younger age public supported this concept, but even the public who was in the age group that would qualify for this license actually supported it, and I think it was about 56% support.
And Director Melcher, of those 56,000 people, how many do you anticipate will actually purchase the license? I mean, I assume that there are many people that don't use the license or use it very little. Have you guys looked at those numbers?
Yeah. Co-Chair Rayfield, we certainly know that there is some component of this 56,000 that simply gets it free because it's free. And I can tell you, for a number of years, my mother was that way. She just simply got it because it was free, and she never went and fished or hunted, but she got the license because it was free. So certainly some proportion of those 56,000 will perhaps not choose to purchase the $6 license. We don't have any way at this point of knowing what that number is, what that dropout is. But it's essentially all, when you go from free to some nominal charge, it's all positive revenue.
When you've done your revenue estimates for the budget, what numbers did you use for your revenue estimates for this portion of the fee adjustments?
Good question, Co-Chair Rayfield. And off the top of my head, I don't know, but we can dig that up and let you know. I believe our economist probably was pretty conservative in recognizing that not all 56,000 will purchase, but we'll have to dig that up.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So a lot of negativity initially, I would say, about this. I will say, though, that the vast majority of groups and individuals that we talk to, when we explain to them the fact that the $6 fee, which is still a 90%+ discount on the cost of the license, leverages $20 for state fish and wildlife-related work, the vast majority of people say, oh, well, when you explain it that way, maybe it's okay. You know, they recognize the positive aspects.
Yes, Senator Hansel.
What total amount of revenue are you anticipating that, if this is adopted, will come into the department?
Co-Chair Rayfield and Senator Hansel, again, I'll have to We'll have to dig into the model and get you the answer to that question, but I don't have it off the top of my head. It is a significant component, though. Okay, moving on. As I mentioned this earlier, I don't know what time. Oh, we're in good shape. I mentioned this earlier, we are proposing a new youth license. One of the things that we heard from the public, both in our survey as well as numerous ideation sessions and other interactions, was the youth licensing system is a mess. It's too complicated. We just want, and I'm speaking on their behalf, we just want one license that covers everything. And we said, you know what, that's a good idea, and it should be really cheap. Again, we want to qualify for the federal match. Free would not qualify for us for the federal match. However, the $10 cost of the license, which in our proposal includes hunting, fishing, shell fishing, it's good for residents and non-resident youth. These is everybody under the age of 18. And also includes the ocean and Columbia River endorsements, so they don't have to purchase those in addition to the fishing license. It's a really good package. Really good package for youth and families. We continued our reduced cost of tags and stamps, so no increases there and no increases to the cost of the juvenile sport pack. Juvenile sport pack is currently $55. The adult sport pack is currently $165. The adult sport pack will increase in our fee proposal over time up to about $195. We're not proposing any increase on the juvenile sport pack. So literally it's, I mean, the cost of an elk tag alone essentially pays for a juvenile sport pack. So for juveniles who are participants in multiple hunting and fishing activities, the sport pack is a really good deal. You've seen this table before. This captures for a few of our select license categories the proposed increases, both in which would be effective in 2016, as well as in each even year out for the next six. You'll see on the hunting side, initially a $4 increase in the hunting license in 2016, followed by simply 50-cent increases in the several out years. Fishing, the large proportion of our funding shortfall and the program within the agency is on the fishing side. You'll see incremental increases of $5 the first year, out $3 in the following years. And then perhaps most importantly, and one of the things we heard a lot of feedback on in the 2009 budget process, we were proposing no change to the controlled hunt application fee. That's the fee that an individual pays when they apply for a controlled hunt, either through one of our vendors or online. And this gets to your question, Co-Chair Rayfield, and this actually comes from the Secretary of State's recent financial audit of the department. The Secretary of State looked at the cost of a hunting license and the cost of a fishing license in 2013. They actually then, using the Consumer Price Index, adjusted the cost, essentially going backward through our fee structure to 1976. And basically concluded that the costs today are pretty consistent with the 1976 cost when adjusted for inflation.
Representative Parrish.
So I got a chance to look at this before we came in here. And the question I have that the audit doesn't share is the value against my license in 1976 is probably a lot different than the value in the 2013 in terms of limits and things that I could go hunt or whatever. I mean, in talking to the people who do hunt and fish in my community, feel like the license is a diminished value given all of the sort of hoops that people have to jump through, and you know, this little short window here, or they get a notice that the season just closed or whatever. That a license today, even though the value isn't there on, I mean, the dollars are a little less than today's dollars, the value doesn't match what somebody got when my dad was hunting in the 70s.
Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Parrish, absolutely, there's always some apples and oranges here when you look at opportunity. I will say, though, that on the fish side, for instance, you can go back to the 1970s, and there was no spring Chinook fishing on the Columbia River. It closed in March every year. And in fact, by the 90s, it was closing in early March every year. We actually have significantly more spring Chinook fishing opportunity on the Columbia now than we did in the mid-1970s. So there are examples, and I only highlight that one, there are examples actually where there is more value delivered now than there was in 1976. And certainly if you talk about mule deer, you know, 1970s mule deer populations in eastern Oregon were at or near record highs. I mean, and that was the case across the West, not just in Oregon. Mule deer populations over the last three decades have declined, not just in Oregon, but across the West. We've got a mule deer initiative where we're working to address those declines through a number of actions, including expanded predator management, habitat manipulation, and other activities or actions. We're certainly seeing some responses. It's early, but we hope to through this package continue those efforts. Okay, commercial fish fund. Part of this fee bill, Senate Bill 247, includes not just the recreational fishing and hunting license fees. It includes a commercial fish fee.
Hold on, Representative Esquivel.
Sal.
Representative Krieger. We're going to finish up on this last slide. Would you guys like to come up and testify?
Sure.
This fee bill, Senate Bill 247, includes both, actually three aspects, not just recreational fishing and hunting. It also includes a commercial fishing fee package as well as a recreational shellfish fee package. As such, under the commercial fish fund strategies, similar pie chart to the recreational fishing package. $1.4 million gap in the commercial fish funded programs projecting out over the next for the next biennium, the 15-17 biennium. Generally, similar strategies that we used on the recreational side, that is a combination of reducing programs, so reducing the current program without proposal to add that back, program efficiencies, fee adjustment, as well as shifting to other revenue where appropriate. This the commercial fish package that's part of Senate Bill 247 was developed with a subgroup of the commercial fishing representatives on our External Budget Advisory Committee. Really a great story of cooperation and collaboration where we sat down with them, highlighted what the budget gaps were, and they really developed a consensus proposal, which is embodied in the commercial fishing section of Senate Bill 247. Okay, at this point, Mr. Co-Chair, I do have several slides that, per Mr. Sievert's request, that highlight the slight differences between the agency request budget and the governor's request budget. And then I can proceed on. Actually, I have about half a dozen slides here that I think would be good segues to tomorrow's discussion of 070 reductions as well as our policy option packages.
That works. We can go ahead and just put a break in it here and then get through some questions. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You mentioned that you had worked with a commercial fisherman. Is that subsequent to the hearing we had earlier? Because we had quite a bit of testimony from the commercial fishermen that both on the Ways and Means Roadshow and then also here that the fees were pretty detrimental to their business and their opinion. Have these come subsequent to that or was that before?
Co-Chair Rayfield and Senator Hansel, I was not on the Ways and Means Roadshow, but I was obviously at the public testimony here earlier in April. I think what you're referring to were comments and concerns by the charter fishing industry, which
correct.
Those fees, the charter and professional guided anglers, they all come under the basic recreational fee structure. So we don't have any standalone commercial fees associated with charter boats. The issue addressed or raised by the charter constituency was one of the combined cost of a daily angling license as well as the three-day shellfish license was going to put them in a position of lack of competitiveness with other states and other activities. And we actually have been, and that's one of the that's one of the beauties of this process is, you know, when people raise issues and concerns, then we look to address them and try to find solutions. And we are, we do have a number of alternatives that we're looking at that actually lower that and hopefully provide a fee structure that's not a barrier for their customers. Primarily, it would include it would create a daily combination fishing shellfish license, if you will. So someone who doesn't want the shellfish part can buy a daily angling license like they do now, but someone who wants to do both on a combination trip would buy a daily combination angling shellfish license. So we are, short answer is, yeah, we're working, or we have options to address those concerns.
Thank you, Representative Gomberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator, for raising an issue that's certainly of critical importance to me and my district. I wanted to go back to a different subject, if I could, Director, because I know there's some good work going on the combined license and in particular concern for the charter fleet. Earlier on today, we talked about outreach to anglers and to hunters and to past anglers and past hunters, and I think those are very good efforts. Could you talk to me a little bit about comparable efforts that we may be making to provide outreach to the 47% of the people that you have told us previously are engaged not in hunting and fishing, but in wildlife viewing activities?
Sure. Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Gomberg, as of course, when we were looking at adjusting our fee structure here, we obviously interviewed and talked to our fee payers. I mean, and so that was the real focus of that survey work, was these, we're looking at the fee-based programs, we're making adjustments to the fees, and we wanted to really hear from them. As we move forward with House Bill 2402, which is the legislative task force on alternative funding, I expect that we will need to engage with the general public, not only our fee-paying customers, but the other folks who enjoy wildlife but don't hunt or fish. So to date, with respect to, we certainly included in our economic surveys folks who did not hunt, the general public at large, but as far as it relates to our fees, we have not surveyed the general public at large.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman, and so your town halls, I infer from your comments today, were aimed primarily at the hunting and fishing community rather than at the broader community at large.
Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Gomberg, absolutely, our public process invites and welcomes all participants, and we have a number of participants both on our EBAC, as well as at our town halls, as well as at the commission. Through the commission process, we have a number of participants that don't represent hunting and fishing groups. They represent other constituents. Those other constituents, if you will, were not part of our fee-specific survey work.
Just one final follow-up, Mr. Chairman. And so, Director, today when you refer to your customer, who precisely are you referring to when you make references to your customer base?
Sure. Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Gomberg, certainly when it relates to our fee-based programs and these fishing and hunting programs within the agency, when we talk about customers, we're talking about the people who are paying the fees and supporting those programs. When we talk about customers and constituents in general as it relates to the agency, we're talking about all Oregonians who value fish and wildlife. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Director.
Yeah. Yes, Senator Demarco. Thanks. Kurt, going back to the question about commercial programs, can you remind me just what is included in the fees on the commercial side? I don't remember I don't remember them coming in and talking about those.
Yeah. Co-Chair Rayfield and Senator Dembrough, I think I believe there were a few individuals that did testify on behalf of the commercial fee piece of this package. In statute, there are a variety of commercial fishing-related licenses as well as fees. So first, at the personal level, an individual who's participating in a commercial fishery has to have a personal commercial fishing license. That covers you, Senator Dembrough, as an individual when you're on the boat participating in those activities. Then the vessel that participates in commercial fishing activity must be licensed and actually gets a license, notwithstanding the required licenses from the State Marine Board or from the federal government for exempted, you know, fishing vessels, but a license from us that licenses the boat to participate in commercial fisheries. Then there's a whole host of permits. So in statute, almost all of them are in statute, there are limited entry permits, whereby only vessels that have a limited entry permit can participate in that particular fishery. So we have, for instance, an ocean troll salmon limited entry permit, Clem River gillnet limited entry permit, Dungeness crab, pink shrimp, a number of limited entry permits, black and blue rockfish, nearshore rockfish. Those permits all have a fee associated with them. And then lastly, those are all annual fees. And then lastly, in statute, there's an ad valorem fee. Essentially, every delivery, when a fisher delivers their product to the processor pays essentially a fee based on the value of the landed catch. And those ad valorem fees range in value from less than 1% up to, I think, 3.15% of the value on salmon. And then lastly, there are a number of wholesale, either fish buyers, fish dealers, processor licenses that these business entities have to procure before running a fish business in the state. So those were all adjusted. And then there's both resident and non-resident for many of those as well.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adjourn for today, and we'll resume tomorrow.
Very good.
Thanks.